So we're looking at that passage which I've just read, Romans chapter 12, verses 9 to 21. Romans chapter 12, verses 9 to 21. And I found myself thinking, when I was reflecting on this passage, that sometimes it's those passages which have the simplest content which are the most difficult to preach. And I think we see that here in Romans 12. Paul, in this passage, gives us this long list of exhortations, commands. He tells us what to do. And nothing within any of these commands is very complicated. It's all relatively simple. Every verse taken by itself makes perfect sense. And if I was to preach a sermon on any one of these commands, any one of these verses, I think that would have been relatively straightforward. The difficulty is trying to work out how it all fits together. You're trying to work out what is the logical flow of Paul in this book. And in the previous chapters, that's not simple, but at least you can say there is a logical flow. He is arguing in a certain direction. When you come to these verses, Romans chapter 12, 9 to 21, you struggle to identify what the flow of thought is at all. So you find yourself asking the central question, well, how do we interpret the overall message of this passage? That's the question which I've wrestled with. And I think perhaps the best place to start then is the first sentence of the passage. In the ESV, the first sentence is this: let love be genuine. And that's a fine translation, but you could translate it even more simply than that. You could just translate it genuine love. Genuine love. And some people think then that verse 9 is not so much a sentence, but really a title. A title for this passage, and actually, in a sense, for all of the passages which follow on after it for the next couple of chapters. You look over the next couple of chapters and you see that love, genuine love, is a recurring theme. Paul will talk about fulfilling the law through love. He will talk about not causing each other to stumble because of love. He will talk about following Christ's loving example over these next few chapters. And so, yes, at first then, the passage before us does just look like a jumble of commands which are difficult to stitch together. But I think at the very least, we can say there's a common theme to these commands, and we find that common theme in the first part of verse 9, genuine love. And that's the theme then that I want us to explore this morning. And in relation to that, I have 3 points to make. Firstly, genuine love is our Christian virtue. Genuine love is our Christian virtue. Verse 9, let love be genuine, abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. Let me ask you a question. Is love a good thing, a bad thing, or a neutral thing? See, when you think about it, you might want to say that love in itself is neither a good thing nor a bad thing. It's a neutral thing. It's good when it's directed towards the right things and in the right proportions, but love in and of itself is not a good thing. I mean, King Ahasuerus, he loved his women, but that wasn't good. He loved them a bit too much, you might think. Joseph Stalin apparently loved little children, but that didn't stop him being a bad man. Adolf Hitler loved chocolate cake, but that didn't really mean anything in the grand scheme of things. So love, you might think, in itself is not virtuous. It all depends on who you love and what you love. And if you love the darkness because your deeds are evil, then you might have love, but you're no better off for having it. In fact, in this Western world we've just been praying about, you might even think that people have made something of an idol out of love. Now, in a sense, everything that I've just said there is true. The Bible does speak about a love for money, for example, which is not a good thing, or a love for self, which is not a good thing, a love for darkness, which is not a good thing. And in all of those cases, love is not a virtue, it is a vice. But at the same time, Paul does talk about love being this Christian virtue, being this peculiar fruit of the Spirit. And for that reason, then, I think Paul would want us to make a distinction. He would want us to make a distinction between what he calls here genuine love and all of those other things that we've just described as love and go by the name of love, but not really are, but aren't really truly genuine love. You see, whatever King Ahasuerus felt when he looked on the naked body of a member of his harem, it wasn't love. Whatever Stalin felt when he looked at that little child, in some sense we could describe that as love, but not genuine love in Paul's sense. Whatever Hitler felt when he looked at a piece of chocolate cake, we might describe those feelings as love, but they are not the same thing that Paul is talking about here in Romans 12. They are not genuine love. They are not this Christian virtue. They are not this fruit of the Spirit. And what Paul is saying here then is that if you, Christian, are to have genuine love, love for God, love for your brother, love for the world in a genuine sense, then you need to abhor what is evil and hold fast to what is good. Let me just try to flesh this out by way of illustration. Let's imagine a member of the church in Rome. Let's call him Justus. And Justus comes to church every Sunday with a beaming smile on his face. He shakes hands with everyone he sees in the congregation. He addresses them all as brother or sister. He loves being on the tea and coffee rota. During the service, Justus prays. He prays for his persecuted brothers in other parts of the empire. He prays for the salvation of non-believers in the city of Rome. So to all appearances, Justus is a lovely, sincere man. But what the church don't realise is that after work on a Monday night, just when Justus is feeling tired and he wants a bit of entertainment, he does something. He follows the crowd and he shuffles guiltily into the Colosseum and he watches the games. And you might think this is a bit of a far-fetched example. Actually, if you read Augustine's Confessions, you'll find a story about a young Christian man who does shuffle guiltily into the Colosseum. And Justus then sits there and watches the games, man versus bear, two gladiators fighting to the death, criminal thrown to the dogs, and Justus soaks it all in and his heart is beating in his chest. And for an hour or so, he embraces in that moment what is evil, and he forgets in that moment what is good. And then he goes home to bed. Well, what is Paul saying to Justus in Romans 12? Well, he's saying that for as long as Justus does that, for as long as he does not abhor what is evil and does not cling fast to what is good, for as long as he actually endorses what is evil and forgets what is good on that Monday night, he is undercutting the genuineness of all the love he has shown in the church the day before. He makes it, he exposes it as insincere. And indeed, more than that, he reduces his capacity for genuine love. A genuine love for the lost, a genuine love for the lowly, a genuine love for the persecuted is incompatible with the evil thrills of the Colosseum. Love of darkness, love of self, love of violence, love of pain, that's not real love. Real love is outward. It desires the betterment of others. And you can't desire the betterment of others while thrilling in the pain of others. Now, I'm not saying Justus has no genuine love for his brothers and sisters, but for as long as he engages in that practice, he is undermining it. He is undercutting it. He is showing it to be more insincere than it could be. And so don't be like Justus this morning. You might give every impression of being a warm-hearted, interested, invested, brotherly Christian this morning, but for as long as you do what is evil, even behind closed doors, whether it's indulging in lust or violence or anger or greed, whether you're mistreating your spouse, whether you're enjoying some perversion on the internet, whether you're wallowing in pride, in all of that evil which you do, you are undermining the genuineness of your love. Genuine love is your Christian virtue. And ultimately then, this love, it comes from God. We read 1 Corinthians 13 earlier on. It's this crowning virtue, isn't it? Everything else passes away, love does not. The greatest of these is love, Paul says. Galatians 5, the fruit of the Spirit. It's the first spiritual fruit that Paul mentions in his list, isn't it? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. In a sense, all of the others, I think, flow out of that first one, love. 1 John chapter 4, it tells us that love is from God, and whoever loves has been born of God and knows God. And perhaps this helps to explain something of our passage here in Romans 12. We have verse 11. Verse 11 seems to be on a different kind of theme, but actually I think it really is still on this theme of love. Do not be slothful in zeal, Paul is saying. I think Paul is saying there that we need to be zealous, energetic lovers. We need to be those who love each other zealously. And where do we get this zeal from? Well, Paul says, be fervent in the Spirit. Literally, burn in the Spirit. Be set on fire by the Spirit. The love that we Christians have for each other and for the lost and for God, it gets its heat and it gets its power from the Spirit of God. And on top of that, then, Paul says, serve the Lord. Your love is an expression of service to Jesus Christ. Perhaps we could say that the more we see life as serving the Lord, the more the Spirit fills us with zeal and the more we love. And as a Christian this morning, I'm saying to you, it's your duty to love your Saviour. Embrace that duty. Whether you're dealing with a fellow brother or unbeliever, you are acting out the love of Christ towards that person. You are following his example. You are obeying his command. You are representing his person. In fact, verse 14 is interesting, isn't it? Paul says there, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse them. Where do those words come from? Well, Paul is quoting from the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus himself first speaks those words. By blessing our persecutors, we are serving Jesus. So, abhor what is evil, cling fast to what is good. If you want your love to be genuine, if you want to demonstrate that it truly is love which finds its origin in God and is a zeal which comes only with the filling of the Spirit and can be performed in service to Christ, then your love needs to be a love which abhors what is evil and clings fast to what is good. Now, I said that our society seems to idolise love. You might think that's true, but I think for as long as our society celebrates what is actually evil, whether it be the evil of abortion or assisted dying laws or pornography, it's working against genuine love. It's promoting a loveless society. It's moving in that direction. It's moving towards a society which values personal freedoms over the genuine love of neighbours. It might justify it through love, apparently, at some level, but actually I think it's working in precisely the opposite direction, because it is not a love which abhors what is evil and holds fast to what is good. It's a love which actually pursues what is evil, and therefore it is no real love at all. It is only self-love, and that is no true love. So let us challenge ourselves this morning. Can we show our society something which is better than that? Something superior to that, something more genuine than that. Let us be those who can show the world that we have a genuine Christian virtue in our love. Let us be those who love genuinely. So, genuine love, it is our Christian virtue. Secondly, genuine love, it is our Christian bond. It is our Christian bond. Now, last week we talked about the church being like a human body. You remember that? We said it's made up of different parts, and many different parts, parts which complement each other, parts which work together, parts which ultimately are bound together. But while a body is bound together by physical bonds, a church, the Church of Jesus Christ, is bound together with bonds of love. Now, in this passage, Paul doesn't carry on that analogy of the human body, but nevertheless, he does emphasize the fact that we Christians are bound together in that close, intimate, mutually dependent way by our love. That genuine love is our Christian bond. And he talks a lot in this passage about the kind of love that Christians are to have towards one another. And I just want to notice now three things which Paul says about this binding love which we as a church ought to be having for each other in this room. Firstly, our love feels. Our love feels. If we are bonded together in this room this morning, we should feel bonded together. You know, it's popular, isn't it, for Christians to say that love isn't a feeling, it's a duty. It's a decision. It's something that we choose to do. And that's true, of course. But you see, love, yes, it's more than just a feeling, but it's not less than a feeling, is it? Love is not less than a feeling. And actually what Paul shows us here is that true, genuine love must be both. Christians have a duty, yes, but they have a duty not just to act lovingly towards one another. They have a duty to pursue affection towards one another. Verse 10, love one another with brotherly affection. Love one another with brotherly affection. You see, the more we Christians think of each other as bonded together, the more we think of each other as brothers and sisters, the more we act to each other as brothers and sisters, the more we should also feel like brothers and sisters. Pursuing this bond of love means pursuing brotherly affection towards one another. What does this look like exactly? Well, Paul tells us, verse 15, he says that we should rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. He goes on to say that we should live in harmony with one another. If we are this harmonious body of Christ, we should have feelings and thoughts which are in harmony. And this is a huge theme, not just here in Romans, it's a huge theme in Paul's letters as a whole. He desires church unity, doesn't he? That's a real imperative for Paul, not just unity of will, but also unity of feeling. We read 1 Corinthians 13 earlier. 1 Corinthians 12, again, adopts that idea of the church being a human body. And it says this. It says that if one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honoured, all are honoured. All rejoice together. And he's saying exactly the same thing here. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. If there's a man in this church who grieves the loss of his wife, we shouldn't be those who try to pull our own hearts out of that situation. Now, to some extent, we have a duty to join with that man in his grief. At the very least, we mustn't allow that man to feel alone in his grief. And the same is true for moments of rejoicing. We shouldn't keep our joys to ourselves. We shouldn't rejoice in an isolated way. We should join with each other in rejoicing. And by doing that, we enhance our joy as a Christian family. I think, in a sense, you could say that the overall effect of this unity is a positive thing for the church. Yes, there's a sacrifice involved when we share in the suffering of someone else, but we are greatly helping that person. And we too then will be greatly helped when we are grieving and we find ourselves surrounded by brothers and sisters who grieve with us, who suffer in solidarity. It's an overall benefit to the church when we harmonize with each other, harmonize our feelings, harmonize our weeping, harmonize our rejoicing. So Christian love, it feels. But then secondly, Christian love, it honors. Our love honors. Verse 16, do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly, never be conceited. Or literally, never be wise. He means never be wise in your own eyes. That's what Paul's saying there. Verse 10, earlier on, he says, outdo one another in showing honor. And this is a theme that we explored last week, and it's a central theme of that previous passage. Loving one another means that we're not haughty. It means that we honor others. It means that we exalt ourselves above honors. We do not exalt ourselves above others. And how can we possibly do that, Paul said in the previous passage, given that we are this one band of brothers together? How can we exalt ourselves over others when we are dependent on each other? And this is what Paul is saying. If you have bonds of genuine Christian love, then you will honor your brothers. You don't have a regard for social expectations about who you should mix with. You associate with the lowly, he says. Your love is not determined by the appearance of a person, or the smell of a person, or the dress of a person. You're not interested in currying favor with those who have the best reputations. You're not interested in celebrity status in the church. There should be no celebrity status in the church. Because to you then, popular Christians are just as honorable as lowly Christians. If you have this genuine love, we don't compete with one another. And if we do compete with one another, we only compete in this sense. We compete in showing honor to one another and to humbling ourselves. So Paul's saying, look, you don't need to get anxious when you see other people being recognized and praised, because you should want them to be recognized and praised. If you have a problem with someone in the church, if you see part of someone's character that you don't like, well, it shouldn't bring you any joy to go around broadcasting that. You should really, out of love, want to keep that to yourself for as long as you can. And for as much as you can think well of a person and think the best of that person, you should. You should assume that you've got it wrong and that the mistake is yours, and that in love then you should honor that other person. And that's what it means then for us to have genuine love in this church. It honors others. And then thirdly, our love, it acts. It acts. I'm not going to say a lot about this now because I think it's very plain what Paul is saying here. And I don't think I need really to really lay this home, but Paul's basically saying, isn't he, that we should love each other not only in words but in deeds. And I'm only drawing attention really to that final comment there at the end of in verse 13. Contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show hospitality. He's saying that our love should act towards one another. We might feel affection towards one another, we might honor one another. Those things are good, but that love, it should progress, and it should progress into activity. And in particular, the activity that Paul mentions here is the contribution to the saints and hospitality. So as brothers and sisters this morning, we should be those who say, yes, I am going to cheerfully support the church with my money and my favours. And nobody's forcing me to, nobody's looking over my shoulder, but I will do it because I want my love to this church to be genuine. I mean, after all, if it wasn't for the love of many people, much generous love, even in recent times, over many years, this church wouldn't be here. It survives because people have expressed their Christian love. And hospitality then, we say, yes, I am going to offer my brothers and sisters my home and my welcome. I am going to go out of my way to be generous to them. And again, I'm not compelled to. Others aren't keeping a tally on me, and it is a sacrifice, but I will do it. I will do it because I want my love for brothers and sisters in this church to be genuine. So I hope then we can all say that. I hope we all have this bond of love, this love which feels in tune with others, which submits and honours others, and which gives up and acts for others. That's what it means then for us to have this genuine bond of love between us. So, genuine love is our Christian virtue. Genuine love is our Christian bond. And then thirdly and finally, genuine love is our Christian weapon. Genuine love is our Christian weapon. I hope what I mean by that will become clear in a few moments. So we mentioned verse 14 a moment ago, and we said that Paul is quoting there from the Sermon on the Mount. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse them. That's Jesus' command to us. But we didn't really talk very much about the content of that verse, and we must do that because it really is a real theme of this passage. And it's this, that Spirit-given, Christ-imitating, genuine love is so different from any other love for this reason, because genuine Christian love is directed towards the most unlikely and most unlovable of people. It's directed towards those who hate us and who hate Christians. That is what makes our love so different from self-love and self-motivated love and indulgent love and sinful love. Our love is directed towards those who hate us. And I'm calling this our Christian weapon, because this is our way as Christians of counterattacking the evil weapons of the world. This is how we respond to the evil which is directed against us. This is how we repay evil. Verse 17, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honourable in the sight of all. So they punch us, and the instinct is for you to punch back. They curse us, and the instinct is for you to curse them back. They slander us, and the instinct is for you to slander them back. They lie about us in the media and misrepresent us and twist the facts and the figures and the statistics to make us look like extreme, ridiculous, hateful Christians, and our instinct is to tell lies about them back and to misrepresent them back and to twist the facts and the figures back. Paul wants us to do none of those things. He wants us to pause and to think and to give thought, as he says in verse 17, and to give thought as to what? To think about how you can respond in such a way that onlookers honour you. They might want to find every possible reason to dislike you. But the way in which you graciously responded to that insult, and the way in which you showed self-control, and the way in which you showed patience, and the way in which you even blessed your persecutors, the way in which you loved your enemy, tells them that you are an honourable person. You give thought to do what is honourable in the sight of all. And the more you do that, the more difficult it will be for them to think otherwise. Because love, you see, is your weapon. It's your response to the hate which comes against you. Whether that be hatred of the world, or whether that be sadly and tragically and sometimes and hopefully rarely, hatred even from our own brothers and sisters. Verse 18, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. They wage war on you. They persistently strive for annoying you and irritating you. And you persistently strive for peace. That family member of yours, that classmate of yours, that co-worker of yours, they want to wind you up. They want you to take the bait. They want relations between you and them to be sour. And their policy towards you then is to keep things sour and to keep things difficult and to keep relations hostile. But that is not our policy. Our policy is to keep building bridges. Our policy is to always be open to holding peace talks. Our policy is always to strive for a ceasefire. Our policy is radical Christian love. And obviously I'm not saying that Christians shouldn't defend themselves or that Christians should be pacifists. We are very grateful for the work of the Christian Institute and the way in which they do stand up to our rights and defend Christians in the public sphere. We should do that. We shouldn't just be squashed. But at the same time, we should fight evil with good. Love is your weapon. Now, you might think, well, is it still quite right to describe love as a weapon? Because really what I'm actually saying is that we put down our weapons and we don't fight back. Well, sort of, but not quite. Because love, it really does fight back. It really can bring you victory in that bad relationship. It really does overcome the enemy. That's what Paul says. Do not be overcome by evil, verse 21, but overcome evil with good. You see, there's a real way in which when you don't obey your instincts and you don't retaliate, and when you, in your heart of hearts, strive to love others and love your enemies, what you do in that situation is you strike them where it matters with your weapon of love. In the words of the previous verse, you heap burning coals upon their heads. Now, what does Paul mean by that? Verse 20. In what sense do we heap coals upon the heads of our enemies? Well, Paul's quoting from Proverbs 25. Let me just read out the verses in their context in Proverbs. You don't need to turn there. They say this: if your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat. And if he is thirsty, give him water to drink. For you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. The north wind brings forth rain and a backbiting tongue, angry looks. So, going back to that co-worker then, or that family member, or that classmate, they give you nothing but abuse, maybe. It might be related to your faith, it might not be related to anything at all. But for whatever reason, they just enjoy to mistreat you. And the desire then is for you to have a backbiting tongue. You see, one day then they're in need. One day they're in trouble. One day they are suffering. And on that day you have two options. You could say, well, after all the grief that you have given me, do you really think that I'm going to help you? And maybe from time to time that approach is wise. But you know, Paul gives you a better option. You can do that person a favour. You can feed that person. You can water that person. You can comfort that person. You can tell them that you're praying for them. And you can do it in a way which is not ostentatious. It's not pretentious. You're doing it genuinely. You're genuinely trying to help. And Proverbs says that when you do that, you heap burning coals upon their heads. Probably it means you burn them. You convict them. You challenge them. You impress them. You make them feel ashamed. You skewer their consciences with your love. And your good works then are like burning coals upon that person's head. And that, Christian, is the best way in which you can wage war on your enemy's soul. Because when you respond like that, when you love your enemy, when you do that, you are ultimately holding out hope that one day your good works might lead your enemy to salvation themselves. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that we don't also desire justice. We do. We don't want the wicked to get away with their wickedness. But as verse 19 tells us, we refrain from executing it ourselves. We leave it to the Lord. We let him bring justice when the time is right. And until that happens, we hope that even in our lifetimes, our good might overcome that person's evil. And finally then, and I think this is probably a good place to finish, I think it's that theme, that idea, which helps to make sense of verse 12. Again, verse 12 looks a little bit out of place, but I think it all fits together with this theme of love. So, remember those words we read from 1 Corinthians 13. Paul there says that love is patient. He says that love is kind. He says that love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. But what does Paul say here in verse 12? He says, rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer. I think those two things are very much related. The genuine love of Christians is a hoping love. It is a patient love. It is a long-suffering love. It is a constantly praying love. It is a hoping that our love might one day overcome their evil and see to the salvation of our enemies. Many people might be against us. Many people might misunderstand us. Many people might treat us badly. But our love for them calls us to wait on the Lord, to be patient with our tribulation, to pray for those people constantly, and ultimately to hope for their salvation. And so please, if you are struggling this morning, if you know what it feels like to be up against that conflict with that other person, and you're feeling their heat, and you're feeling the difficulty of dealing with them, and you might even describe that person as your enemy, well, please respond in your special Christian way. Use your special Christian weapon. Employ your genuine love towards that person. And by loving them and loving them and always loving them, we trust that we will overcome evil with good. May the Lord help us in this as we seek to apply these difficult and challenging words. Amen.